What death threat would this be, exactly?
The killing curse! He pretended to use the killing curse on us!
Professor Sprout turned to look at Harry.
Yes, quite a terrible threat from an 11-year-old boy. Though, still not something you should ever dream of pretending, Harry Potter.
I don't even know the words to the killing curse, Harry said promptly. And I didn't have my wand out at any time.
Now Professor Sprout was giving Harry a sceptical look.
I suppose this boy hit himself with two pies, then? He didn't use his wand,
blurted one of the young Hufflepuffs.
I don't know how he did it either. He just snapped his fingers and there was pie.
Really?
Said Professor Sprout after a pause. She drew her own wand.
I won't require it, since you do seem to be the victim here. But would you mind it if I checked your wand to verify that?
Harry took out his wand.
What do I...
Prior incantato,
said Sprout. She frowned.
That's odd. Your wand doesn't seem to have been used at all.
Harry shrugged.
It hasn't, actually. I only got my wand and school books a few days ago.
Sprout nodded.
Then we have a clear case of accidental magic from a boy who felt threatened. And the rules plainly state that you are not to be held responsible. As for you...
She turned to the Slytherins. Her eyes dropped deliberately to Neville's books lying on the floor. There was a long silence, during which she looked at the five Slytherins.
3 points from Slytherin. Each.
She said finally.
And 6 from him.
Pointing to the boy covered in pie.
Don't ever meddle with my Hufflepuffs again, or my student Harry Potter either. Now go.
She didn't have to repeat herself. The Slytherins turned and walked away very quickly. Neville went and started picking up his books. He seemed to be crying, but only a little. It might have been from delayed shock, or it might have been because the other boys were helping him.
Thank you very much, Harry Potter,
Professor Sprout said to him.
7 points to Ravenclaw, 1 for each Hufflepuff you helped protect, and I won't say anything more.
Harry blinked. He'd been expecting something more along the lines of a lecture about keeping himself out of trouble and a rather severe scolding for missing his very first class. Maybe he should have gone to Hufflepuff. Sprout was cool.
Scorchify,
Sprout said to the mess of pie on the floor, which promptly vanished. And she left, walking along the hall that led to the green study room.
How did you do that?
Hissed one of the Hufflepuff boys as soon as she was gone. Harry smiled smugly.
I can make anything I want happen just by snapping my fingers.
The boy's eyes widened.
Really?
No, said Harry. But when you're telling everyone this story, be sure to share it with Hermione Granger in first year Ravenclaw. She has an anecdote you might find amusing.
He had absolutely no clue what was happening, but he wasn't about to pass up the opportunity to add to his growing legend.
Oh, and what was all that about the killing curse?
The boy gave him a strange look.
You really don't know? If I did, I wouldn't be asking. The words to the killing curse are...
The boy swallowed and his voice dropped to a whisper, and he held his hands away from his sides as if to make it very clear that he wasn't holding a wand.
Avada Kedavra. Well, of course they are.
Harry put this on his growing list of things to never, ever tell his dad, Professor Michael Varys Evans. It was bad enough talking about how you were the only person to survive the fearsome killing curse without having to admit that the killing curse was abracadabra.
I see, Harry said after a pause. Well, that's the last time I ever say that before snapping my fingers.
Though it had produced an effect that might be tactically useful.
Why did you? Raised by muggles. Muggles think it's a joke and that it's funny. Seriously, that's what happened. Sorry, but can you remind me of your name? I'm Ernie Macmillan, said the Hufflepuff.
He held out his hand and Harry shook it.
Honored to meet you.
Harry executed a slight bow.
Pleased to meet you. Skip the honored thing.
Then the other boys crowded round him and there was a sudden flood of introductions. When they were done, Harry swallowed. This was going to be very difficult.
If everyone would excuse me, I have something to say to Neville.
All eyes turned to Neville, who took a step back, his face looking apprehensive.
As suppose,
Neville said in a tiny voice,
you're going to say I should have been braver. Oh, no, nothing like that,
Harry said hastily.
Nothing to do with that. It's just, something the Sorting Hat told me.
Suddenly, the other boys looked very interested, except for Neville, who was looking even more apprehensive. There seemed to be something blocking Harry's throat. He knew he should just blurt it out, and it was like he'd swallowed a large brick that was just stuck in the way. It was like Harry had to manually take control of his lips and produce each syllable individually. But he managed to make it happen.
I'm sorry.
He exhaled and took a deep breath.
For what I did, the other day. You don't have to be gracious about it or anything. I'll understand if you just hate me. This isn't about me trying to look cool by apologizing, or your having to accept it. What I did was wrong.
There was a pause. Neville clutched his books tighter to his chest.
Where did you do it?
He said in a thin, wavering voice. He blinked as if trying to hold back tears.
Where does everyone do that to me? Even the boy who lived?
Harry suddenly felt smaller than he ever had in his life.
I'm sorry,
Harry said again, his voice now hoarsened.
It's just, you looked scared. It was like a sign over your head saying, victim. And I wanted to show you that things don't always turn out badly. That sometimes the monsters give you chocolate. I thought if I showed you that, you might realize there wasn't so much to be afraid of.
But there is,
whispered Neville.
You saw it today. There is.
They wouldn't have done anything really bad in front of witnesses. Their main weapon is fear. That's why they target you, because they can see you're afraid. I wanted to make you less afraid, show you that the fear was always worse than the thing itself. Oh, that's what I told myself. But the Sorting Hat told me that I was lying to myself and that I really did it because it was fun. So, that's why I'm apologizing.
You hurt me, said Neville. Just now, when you grabbed me and pulled me away from them.
Neville held out his arm and pointed to where Harry had grabbed him.
I might have a bruise here later from how hard you pulled. You hurt me worse than anything the Slytherins did by bumping into me, actually.
Neville, hissed Ernie. He was trying to save you.
I'm sorry, whispered Harry. When I saw that, I just got really angry.
Neville looked at him steadily.
So, you yanked me out really hard and put yourself in where I was and went, "Hello, I'm the boy who lived."
Harry nodded.
I think you're going to be really cool someday, Neville said. But right now, you're not.
Harry swallowed the sudden knot in his throat and walked away. He continued down the corridor to the intersection, then turned left into a hallway and kept on walking blindly. What was he supposed to do here? Never get angry? He wasn't sure he could have done anything without being angry, and who knows what would have happened to Neville and his books then? Besides, Harry had read enough fantasy books to know how this one went. He would try to suppress the anger, and he would fail, and it would keep coming out again. And after this whole long journey of self-discovery, he would learn at the end that his anger was a part of himself, and that only by accepting it could he learn to use it wisely. Star Wars was the only universe in which the answer actually was that you were supposed to cut yourself off completely from negative emotions, and something about Yoda had always made Harry hate the little green moron. So, the obvious, time-saving plan was to skip the journey of self-discovery and go straight to the part where he realized that only by accepting his anger as part of himself could he stay in control of it. The problem was that he didn't feel out of control when he was angry. The cold rage made him feel like he was in control. It was only when he looked back that events as a whole seemed to have blown up out of control, somehow. He wondered how much the game controller cared about that sort of thing, and whether he'd won or lost points for it. Harry himself felt like he'd lost quite a few points, and he was sure the old lady in the picture would have told him that his was the only opinion that mattered. And Harry was also wondering whether the game controller had sent Professor Sprout. It was the logical thought. The note had threatened to notify the game authorities. And then, there Professor Sprout was. Maybe Professor Sprout was the game controller. The head of House Hufflepuff would be the last person anyone would suspect, which ought to put her near the top of Harry's list. He'd read one or two mystery novels, too. So, how am I doing in the game? Harry said out loud. A sheet of paper flew over his head as if someone had thrown it from behind him. Harry turned around, but there was no one there. And when Harry turned forwards again, the note was settling to the floor. The note said,
Points for style. 10. Points for good thinking. Minus 3 million. Ravenclaw house points bonus. 70. Current points. Minus 2,999,871. Turns remaining. 2.
Minus 3 million points?
Harry said indignantly to the empty hallway.
That seems excessive. I want to file an appeal with the game authorities. And how am I supposed to make up 3 million points in the next 2 turns?
Another note flew over his head.
Appeal failed. Asking the wrong questions, minus 1 trillion points. Current points, minus 1,002,999,871. Turns remaining, 1.
Harry gave up. With 1 turn remaining, all he could do was take his best shot, even if it wasn't very good.
My guess is that the game represents life.
A final sheet of paper flew over his head, reading,
Attempt failed. 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 Current points, minus infinity. You have lost the game. Final instruction.
Go to Professor McGonagall's office.
The last line was in his own handwriting. Harry stared at the last line for a while, then shrugged. Fine. Professor McGonagall's office it would be. If she was the game controller... Okay, honestly, Harry had absolutely no idea how he would feel if Professor McGonagall was the game controller. His mind was just drawing a complete blank. It was literally unimaginable. A couple of portraits later, it wasn't a long trip, Professor McGonagall's office wasn't far from her transfiguration classroom, at least not on Mondays, on odd-numbered years, Harry stood outside the door to her office. He knocked.
Come in,
said Professor McGonagall's muffled voice. He entered. Chapter 14. The Unknown and the Unknowable. There were mysterious questions, but a mysterious answer was a contradiction in terms.
Come in,
said Professor McGonagall's muffled voice. Harry did so. The office of the deputy headmistress was clean and well organized. On the wall, immediately adjacent to the desk, was a maze of wooden cubbyholes, of all shapes and sizes, mostly with several parchment scrolls thrust into them, and it was, somehow, very clear that Professor McGonagall knew exactly what every cubbyhole meant, even if no one else did. A single parchment lay on the actual desk, which was, aside from that, clean. Behind the desk was a closed door barred with several locks. Professor McGonagall was sitting on a backless stool behind the desk, looking puzzled. Her eyes had widened with perhaps a slight note of apprehension as she saw Harry.
Mr. Potter,
said Professor McGonagall,
what is this about?
Harry's mind went blank. He'd been instructed by the game to come here. He had been expecting her to have something in mind.
Mr. Potter,
said Professor McGonagall, starting to look slightly annoyed. Thankfully, Harry's panicking brain remembered at this point that he did have something he'd been planning to discuss with Professor McGonagall. Something important and well worth her time.
Harry said, if there are any spells you can cast to make sure no one's listening to us?
Professor McGonagall stood up from her chair, firmly closed the outer door, and began taking out her wand and saying spells. It was at this point that Harry realized he was faced with a priceless and possibly irreplaceable opportunity to offer Professor McGonagall a cup of tea, and he couldn't believe he was seriously thinking that. And it would be fine. The soda would vanish after a few seconds. And he told that part of himself to shut up. It did, and Harry began to organize mentally what he was going to say. He hadn't planned to have this discussion quite so soon, but so long as he was here... Professor McGonagall finished a spell that sounded a lot older than Latin, and then she sat down again.
"All right,"
she said in a quiet voice.
"New ones listening?"
Her face was rather tight.
"Oh, right. She's expecting me to blackmail her for information about the prophecy."
"Nah, Harry'd get around to that some other day."
"It's about the incident with the sorting hat," Harry said.
Professor McGonagall blinked.
I think there's an extra spell on the sorting hat. Something that the sorting hat itself doesn't know about. Something that triggers when the sorting hat says Slytherin. I heard a message that I'm pretty sure Ravenclaws aren't supposed to hear. It came the moment the sorting hat was off my head, and I felt the connection break. It sounded like a hiss, and like English at the same time."
There was a sharp intake of breath from McGonagall.
"And it said, 'Salutations from Slytherin to Slytherin. If you would seek my secrets, speak to my snake.'"
Professor McGonagall sat there with her mouth open, staring at Harry as if he had grown another two heads.
"So,"
Professor McGonagall said slowly, as though she couldn't believe the words that were coming out of her own lips.
"You decided to come to me right away and tell me about it?"
"Well, yes, of course," Harry said.
There was no need to admit how long it had taken him to actually think of that.
"As opposed to, say, trying to research it myself, or telling any of the other children."
"I see,"
Professor McGonagall said.
"And if, perhaps, you were to discover the entrance to Salazar Slytherin's legendary Chamber of Secrets, an entrance that you... and you alone could open?"
"I would close the entrance and report to you at once so that a team of experienced magical archaeologists could be assembled,"
Harry said promptly.
"Then I would open up the entrance again and they would go in very carefully to make sure that there was nothing dangerous. I might go in later to look around, or if they needed me to open up something else, but it would be after the area had been declared clear and they had photographs of how everything looked before people started tromping around their priceless historical site."
Professor McGonagall sat there with her mouth open, staring at him like he'd just turned into a cat.
"It's obvious if you're not a Gryffindor," Harry said kindly.
"I think,"
Professor McGonagall said in a rather choked voice,
"that you far underestimate the rarity of common sense, Mr. Potter."
That sounded about right. Although,
a Hufflepuff would have said the same thing.
McGonagall paused, struck.
That's true.
Sorting Hat offered me Hufflepuff."
She blinked at him as though she couldn't believe her own ears.
"Did it really?"
"Yes."
"Mr. Potter,"
McGonagall said, and now her voice was low.
"5 decades ago was the last time a student died within the walls of Hogwarts.
and I'm now certain that 5 decades ago was the last time someone heard that message.
A chill went through Harry. Then I will be very sure to take no action whatsoever on this matter without consulting you, Professor McGonagall. He paused. And may I suggest that you get together the best people you can find and see if it's possible to get that extra spell off the Sorting Hat. And if you can't do that, maybe put on another spell, a quietus that briefly activates just as the hat is being removed from a student's head. That might work as a patch. There! No more dead students.
Harry nodded in satisfaction. Professor McGonagall looked even more stunned, if such a thing were imaginable.
He cannot possibly award you enough points for this without giving the house cup to Ravenclaw outright.
Harry said. I'd rather not earn that many house points.
Now Professor McGonagall was giving him a strange look.
Why not?
Harry was having a little difficulty putting it into words.
Because it would be just too sad, you know? Like back when I was still trying to go to school in the Muggle world, and whenever there was a group project, I'd go ahead and do the whole thing myself because the others would only slow me down. I'm fine with earning lots of points, more than anyone else even, but if I earn enough to be decisive in winning the House Cup just by myself, then it's like I'm carrying House Ravenclaw on my back, and that's too sad.
A. C.
McGonagall said hesitantly. It was apparent that this way of thinking had never occurred to her.
Suppose I only awarded you 50 points, then?
Harry shook his head again.
It's not fair to the other children if I earn lots of points for grown-up things that I can be a part of and they can't. How is Terry Boot supposed to earn 50 points for reporting a whisper he heard from the Sorting Hat? It wouldn't be fair at all.
See why the Sorting Hat offered you Hufflepuff,
said Professor McGonagall. She was eyeing him with a strange respect. That made Harry choke up a bit. He'd honestly thought he wasn't worthy of Hufflepuff, that the Sorting Hat had just been trying to shove him anywhere but Ravenclaw, into a house whose virtues he didn't have. Professor McGonagall was smiling now.
And if I tried to give you 10 points?
Are you going to explain where those 10 points came from, if anyone asks? There might be a lot of Slytherins, and I don't mean the children at Hogwarts, who would be really, really angry if they knew about the spell being taken off the Sorting Hat and found out I was involved. So I think that absolute secrecy is the better part of valour. No need to thank me, ma'am. Virtue is its own reward.
So it is,
McGonagall said.
But I do have a very special something else to give you. I see that I have greatly wronged you in my thoughts, Mr. Potter. Please wait here.
She got up, went over to the locked back door, waved her wand, and a sort of blurry curtain sprang up around her. Harry could neither see nor hear what was going on. It was a few minutes later that the blur vanished and Professor McGonagall was standing there, facing him with the door behind her, looking as though it had never been opened. And Professor McGonagall held out in one hand a necklace, a thin golden chain bearing in its centre a silver circle, within which was the device of an hourglass.
In her other hand was a folded pamphlet.
"This is for you,"
she said. Wow! He was going to get some sort of neat magical item as a quest reward. Apparently that business with refusing offers of monetary rewards until you got a magic item actually worked in real life, not just computer games. Harry accepted his new necklace, smiling.
What is it?
Professor McGonagall took a breath.
Mr. Potter, this is an item which is ordinarily lent only to children who have already shown themselves to be highly responsible in order to help them with difficult class schedules.
McGonagall hesitated, as though about to add something else.
I must emphasize, Mr. Potter, that this item's true nature is secret, and that you must not tell any of the other students about it, or let them see you using it. If that's not acceptable to you, then you can give it back now.
I can keep secrets, Harry said. So, what does it do?
So far as the other students are concerned, this is a spinster wicket, and it is used to treat a rare, non-contagious magical ailment called spontaneous duplication. You wear it under your clothes, and while you have no reason to show it to anyone, you also have no reason to treat it as an awful secret. Spinster wickets are not interesting. Do you understand, Mr. Potter?
Harry nodded, his smile widening. He sensed the work of a competent Slytherin.
And what does it really do?
It's a time turner. Each spin of the hourglass sends you 1 hour back in time. So, if you use it to go back 2 hours every day, you should always be able to get to sleep at the same time.
Harry's suspension of disbelief blew completely out the window.
You're giving me a time machine to treat my sleeping disorder. You're giving me a time machine to treat my sleep disorder. You're giving me a time machine in order to treat my sleep disorder?
Harry's mouth said. He was now holding the necklace away from him as though it were a live bomb. Not as if it were a live bomb. That didn't begin to describe the severity of the situation. Harry held the necklace away from him as though it were a time machine.
Say, Professor McGonagall, did you know that time-reversed ordinary matter looks just like antimatter? Why, yes, it does. Did you know that 1 kilogram of antimatter encountering 1 kilogram of matter will annihilate in an explosion equivalent to 43 million tons of TNT? Do you realize that I myself weigh 41 kilograms and that the resulting blast would leave a giant smoking crater where there used to be Scotland? Excuse me,
Harry managed to say,
but this sounds really, 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 really dangerous.
Harry's voice didn't quite rise to a shriek. He couldn't possibly scream loud enough to do this situation justice, so there was no point in trying. Professor McGonagall looked upon him with tolerant affection.
I'm glad you're taking this seriously, Mr. Potter, but time-turners aren't that dangerous. We wouldn't give them to children if they were.
Really? Harry said. Ah, of course you wouldn't give time machines to children if they were dangerous. What was I thinking? Just to be clear, sneezing on this device will not send me into the Middle Ages, where I will run over Gutenberg with a horse guard and prevent the Enlightenment. Because, you know, I hate it when that happens to me.
McGonagall's lips were twitching in that way she had when she was trying not to smile. She offered Harry the pamphlet she was holding, but Harry was carefully holding out the necklace with both hands and staring at the hourglass to make sure it wasn't about to turn.
"Don't worry,"
McGonagall said after a momentary pause when it became clear that Harry wasn't going to move.
"It can't possibly happen, Mr. Potter. The time turner cannot be used to move more than 6 hours backwards. It can't be used more than 6 times in any day."
"Oh, good. Very good, that. And if someone bumps into me, the time turner will not break and will not trap the whole castle of Hogwarts in an endlessly repeating loop of Thursdays."
"Well, they can be fragile," said McGonagall. "And I do think I've heard about strange things happening if they're broken, but nothing like that."
"Perhaps," Harry said when he could speak again, "you ought to provide your time machines with some sort of protective shell, rather than leaving the glass exposed, so as to prevent that from happening."
McGonagall looked quite struck.
"That's an excellent idea, Mr. Potter. I shall inform the Ministry of it."
"That's it. It's official now. They've ratified it in Parliament. Everyone in the wizarding world is completely stupid. And, well, I hate to get all philosophical..."
Harry desperately tried to lower his voice to something under a shriek.
"Has anyone thought about the implications of going back 6 hours and doing something that changes time, which would pretty much delete all the people affected and replace them with different versions?"
"You can't change time,"
Professor McGonagall interrupted.
"Good heavens, Mr. Potter, do you think these would be allowed to be given to students if that was possible? What if someone tried to change their test scores?"
Harry took a moment to process this. His hands relaxed, just a little, from their white grip on the hourglass chain, like he wasn't holding a time machine, just a live nuclear warhead.
"So," Harry said slowly, "people just find that the universe happens to be self-consistent, somehow, even though it has time travel in it. If I and my future self interact, then I'll see the same thing as both of me, even though, on my own first run through, my future self is already acting in full knowledge of things that, from my own perspective, haven't happened yet."
Harry's voice trailed off into the inadequacy of English.
"Correct, I think,"
said Professor McGonagall.
"Although wizards are advised to avoid being seen by their past selves. If you're attending two classes at the same time, and you need to cross paths with yourself, for example, the first version of you should step aside and close his eyes at a known time. You have a watch already? Good. So that the future you can pass. It's all there in the pamphlet."
"And what happens when someone ignores that advice?"
Professor McGonagall pursed her lips.
"I understand that it can be quite disconcerting."
"And it doesn't, create a paradox that destroys the universe?"
She smiled tolerantly.
"Mr. Potter, I think I'd remember hearing if that had ever happened.
That is not reassuring. Haven't you people ever heard of the anthropic principle? And what idiot ever built one of these things for the first time?
Professor McGonagall actually laughed. It was a pleasant, glad sound that seemed surprisingly out of place on that stern face.
You're having another "you turned into a cat" moment, aren't you, Mr. Potter? You probably don't want to hear this, but it's quite endearingly cute.
Turning into a cat doesn't even begin to compare to this. You know, right up until this moment, I had this awful suppressed thought somewhere in the back of my mind that the only remaining answer was that my whole universe was a computer simulation like in the book Simulacron 3. But now, even that is ruled out because this little toy isn't Turing computable. A Turing machine could simulate going back into a defined moment of the past and computing a different future from there. An Oracle machine could rely on the halting behavior of lower-order machines. But what you're saying is that reality somehow self-consistently computes in one sweep using information that hasn't happened yet.
Realization struck Harry a pile-driver blow. It all made sense now. It all finally made sense.
So that's how the committee works. Of course. The spell doesn't force funny events to happen. It just makes you feel an impulse to drink right before funny things are going to happen anyway. Oh, I'm such a fool. I should have realized when I felt the impulse to drink the committee before Dumbledore's second speech. Didn't drink it, and then choked on my own saliva instead. Drinking the committee doesn't cause the comedy. The comedy causes you to drink the committee. I saw the two events were correlated and assumed the comedy had to be the cause and the comedy had to be the effect because I thought temporal order, restrained causation, and causal graphs had to be acyclic. But it all makes sense once you draw the causal arrows going backwards in time.
Realization struck Harry the second pile driver. This one he managed to keep quiet, making only a small strangling sound, like a dying kitten, as he realized who'd put the note on his bed this morning. Professor McGonagall's eyes were alight.
After you graduate, or possibly even before, you really must teach some of these muggle theories at Hogwarts, Mr. Potter. They seem quite fascinating, even if they're all wrong.
Professor McGonagall offered him a few more pleasantries, demanded a few more promises, to which Harry nodded, said something about not talking to snakes where anyone could hear him, reminded him to read the pamphlet, and then somehow Harry found himself standing outside her office with the door closed firmly behind him. Harry said. Why, yes, his mind was blown. Not least by the fact that, if not for the prank, he might well have never obtained a time-turner in the first place. Or would Professor McGonagall have given it to him anyway, only later in the day, whenever he got around to asking about his sleep disorder, or telling her about the Sorting Hat's message? And would he, at that time, have wanted to pull a prank on himself which would have led to him getting the time-turner earlier, so that the only self-consistent possibility was the one in which the prank started before he even woke up in the morning? Harry found himself considering, for the first time in his life, that the answer to his question might be literally inconceivable.
that, since his own brain contained neurons that only ran forwards in time, there was nothing his brain could do, no operation it could perform, which was conjugate to the operation of a time-turner. Up until this point, Harry had lived by the admonition of E.T. James, that if you were ignorant about a phenomenon, that was a fact about your own state of mind, not a fact about the phenomenon itself. That your uncertainty was a fact about you, not a fact about whatever you were uncertain about. That ignorance existed in the mind, not in reality. That a blank map did not correspond to a blank territory. There were mysterious questions, but a mysterious answer was a contradiction in terms. A phenomenon could be mysterious to some particular person, but there could be no phenomenon mysterious of themselves. To worship a sacred mystery was just to worship your own ignorance. So, Harry had looked upon magic and refused to be intimidated. People had no sense of history. They learned about chemistry and biology and astronomy, and thought that these matters had always been the proper meat of science, that they had never been mysterious. The stars had once been mysteries. Lord Kelvin had once called the nature of life and biology the response of muscles to human will and the generation of trees from seeds a mystery infinitely beyond the reach of science. Not just a little beyond, mind you, but infinitely beyond. Lord Kelvin certainly had felt a huge emotional charge from not knowing something. Every mystery ever solved had been a puzzle from the dawn of human species right up until someone solved it. Now, for the first time, he was up against the prospect of a mystery that was threatening to be permanent. If time didn't work by acyclical causal networks, then Harry didn't understand what was meant by cause and effect. And if Harry didn't understand cause and effects, then he didn't understand what sort of stuff reality might be made of instead. And it was entirely possible that his human mind never could understand, because his brain was made out of old-fashioned linear time neurons, and this had turned out to be an impoverished subset of reality. On the plus side, the Comet T, which had once seemed all-powerful and all-unbelievable, had turned out to have a much simpler explanation, which he had missed merely because the truth was completely outside his hypothesis space, or anything that his brain had evolved to comprehend. But now, he actually had figured it. Probably. Which was sort of encouraging. Sort of. Harry glanced down at his watch. It was nearly 11 a.m. He had gotten to sleep last night at 1 a.m., so in the natural state of affairs, he'd go to sleep tonight at 3 a.m. So, to go to sleep at 7 p.m. and wake up at 7 a.m, he should go back 5 total hours. Which meant that if he wanted to get back to his dorm at around 6 a.m., before anyone was awake, he'd better hurry up and... Even in retrospect, Harry didn't understand how he'd pulled off half the stuff involved in the prank. Where had the pie come from? Harry was starting to seriously fear time travel. On the other hand, he had to admit that it had been an irreplaceable opportunity. A prank you could only pull on yourself once in a lifetime, within 6 hours of when you first found out about time-turners. In fact, there was even more puzzling when Harry thought about it. Time had presented him with the finished prank as a fait accompli, and yet it was quite clearly his own handiwork. Concept and execution and writing style. Every last part,
even the ones he still didn't understand. Well, time was a-wasting, and there were at most 30 hours in a day. Harry didn't know some of what he had to do, and he might figure out the rest, like the pie, while he was working. There was no point putting it off. He couldn't exactly accomplish anything stuck here in the future. 5 hours earlier, Harry was sneaking into his dorm with his robes pulled up over his head as a thin sort of disguise, just in case someone was already up and about and saw him at the same time as Harry lying in his bed. He didn't want to have to explain to anyone about his little medical problem with spontaneous duplication. Fortunately, it seemed that everyone was still asleep. And there also seemed to be a box, wrapped in red and green paper, with a bright golden ribbon lying next to his bed. The perfect stereotypical image of a Christmas present, although it wasn't Christmas. Harry crept in as softly as he could manage, just in case someone had their quieter turned down low. There was an envelope attached to the box, closed by plain clear wax, without a seal impressed. Harry carefully pried the envelope open and took out the letter inside. The letter said, "This is the cloak of invisibility of Ignatius Peverell, passed down through his descendants, the Potters. Unlike lesser cloaks and spells, it has the power to keep you hidden, not merely invisible. Your father lent it to me to study shortly before he died, and I confess that I have received much good use of it over the years. In the future, I shall have to get along with disillusionment, I fear. It is time the cloak was returned to you, its heir. I had thought to make this a Christmas present, but it wished to come back to your hand before then. It seems to expect you have need of it. Use it well. No doubt you are already thinking of all manner of wonderful pranks as your father committed in his day. If his full misdeeds were known, every woman in Gryffindor would gather to desecrate his grave. I shall not try to stop history from repeating, but be most careful not to reveal yourself. If Dumbledore saw a chance to possess one of the Deathly Hallows, he would never let it escape his grasp until the day he died. A very Merry Christmas to you." The note was unsigned.
"Hold on!"
Harry said, pulling up short as the other boys were about to leave the Ravenclaw dorm.
Sorry, there's something else I've got to do with my trunk. I'll be along to breakfast in a couple of minutes."
Terry Boot scowled at Harry.
"You'd better not be planning to go through any of our things."
Harry held up one hand.
"I swear that I intend to do nothing of the sort to any of your things, that I only intend to access objects that I myself own, that I have no pranking or otherwise questionable intentions towards any of you, and that I do not anticipate those intentions changing before I get to breakfast in the Great Hall."
Terry frowned.
"Wait, is that..."
"Don't worry,"
said Penelope Clearwater, who was there to guide them.
"There were no loopholes. Well worded, Potter. You should be a lawyer."
Harry Potter blinked at that. Yes. Ravenclaw. Prefect.
Thank you," he said. "I think."
"When you try to find the Great Hall, you will get lost."
Penelope stated this in the tones of a flat, unarguable fact.
"As soon as you do, ask a portrait how to get to the first floor. Ask another portrait the instant you suspect you might be lost again, especially if it seems like you're going up higher and higher. If you're higher than the whole castle ought to be, stop and wait for search parties. Otherwise, we shall see you again 4 months later, and you will be 5 months older and dressed in a loincloth and covered in snow, and that's if you stay inside the castle."
"Understood,"
said Harry, swallowing hard.
Shouldn't you tell students all that sort of stuff right away?
Penelope sighed.
What? All of it? That would take weeks. You'll pick it up as you go along.
She turned to go, followed by the other students.
If I don't see you at breakfast in 30 minutes, Potter, I'll start the search.
Once everyone was gone, Harry attached the note to his bed. He had already written it and all the other notes working in his cavern level before everyone else woke up. Then he carefully reached inside the quietus field and pulled the cloak of invisibility off Harry One's still sleeping form. And, just for the sake of mischief, Harry put the cloak into Harry One's pouch, knowing it would thereby already be in his own.
I can see that the message has passed on to Cornelian Flubberwelt,
said the painting of a man with aristocratic airs, and in fact a perfectly normal nose.
Might I ask where it came from originally?
Harry shrugged with artful helplessness.
I was told that it was spoken by a hollow voice that belled forth from a gap within the air itself, a gap that opened upon a fiery abyss.
Hey!
Hermione said in tones of indignation from her place on the other side of the breakfast table.
That's everyone's dessert. You can't just take one whole pie and put it in your pouch.
I'm not taking one pie. I'm taking two. Sorry, everyone. Gotta run now.
Harry ignored the cries of outrage and left the Great Hall. He needed to arrive at herbology class a little early. Professor Sprout eyed him sharply.
And how do you know what the Slytherins are planning?
I can't name my sources, Harry said. In fact, I have to ask you to pretend that this conversation never happened. Just act like you happened across them naturally while you were on an errand or something. I'll run on ahead as soon as Herbology gets out. I think I can distract the Slytherins until you get there. I'm not easy to scare or bully, and I don't think they'll dare to seriously hurt the boy who lived. Though, I'm not asking you to run in the hallways, but I would appreciate it if you didn't dawdle along the way.
Professor Sprout looked at him for a long moment, then her expression softened.
Please be careful with yourself, Harry Potter, and... thank you.
Just be sure not to be late, Harry said. And remember, when you get there, you weren't expecting to see me, and this conversation never happened.
It was horrible watching himself yank Neville out of the circle of Slytherins. Neville had been right. He'd used too much force. Way too much force.
Hello, Harry Potter said coldly. I'm the boy who lived.
8 first-year boys, mostly the same height. One of them had a scar on his forehead, and he wasn't acting like the others.
Oh, would some power the gift he gie us, to see ourselves as others see us. It wad free money of wonder free us. A foolish notion.
Professor McGonagall was right. The Sorting Hat was right. It was clear once you saw it from the outside. There was something wrong with Harry Potter. Chapter 15. Conscientiousness.
I'm sure I'll find the time somewhere. Frigidairo!
Harry dipped a finger in the glass of water on his desk. It should have been cool, but lukewarm it was, and lukewarm it had stayed.
again.
Harry was feeling very, very cheated. There were hundreds of fantasy novels scattered around the Verus household. Harry had read quite a few, and it was starting to look like he had a mysterious dark side. So, after the glass of water had refused to cooperate the first few times, Harry had glanced around the charm's classroom to make sure no one was watching, and then taken a deep breath, concentrated, and made himself angry. Thought about the Slytherins bullying Neville, and the game where someone knocked down your books every time you tried to pick them up again. Thought about what Draco Malfoy had said about the 10-year-old Lovegood girl, and how the Wizengamot really operated. And the fury had entered his blood. He had held out his wand in a hand that trembled with hate and said in cold tones, "Frigid Dyro!" And absolutely nothing had happened. Harry had been gypped. He wanted to write to someone and demand a refund on his dark side, which clearly ought to have irresistible magical power, but had turned out to be defective.
"Frigid Dyro,"
said Hermione again from the desk next to him. Her water was solid ice, and there were white crystals forming on the rim of her glass. She seemed to be totally intent on her own work and not at all conscious of the other students staring at her with hateful eyes, which was either A, dangerously oblivious of her, or B, a perfectly honed performance rising to the level of a fine art.
"Oh, very good, Miss Granger!"
squeaked Phileas Flitwick, the charms professor and head of Ravenclaw. A tiny little man with no visible signs of being a past dueling champion.
"Excellent! Stupendous!"
Harry had expected to be, in the worst case, second behind Hermione. Harry would have preferred for her to be rivaling him, of course, but he could have accepted it the other way around. As of Monday, Harry was headed for the bottom of the class, a position for which he was companionably rivaling all the other muggle-raised students, except Hermione, who was all alone and rivalless at the top. Poor thing. Professor Flitwick was standing over the desk of one of the other muggle-borns and quietly adjusting the way she was holding her wand. Harry looked over at Hermione. He swallowed hard. It was the obvious role for her in the scheme of things.
"Hermione," Harry said tentatively, "do you have any idea what I might be doing wrong?"
Hermione's eyes lit up with a terrible light of helpfulness, and something in the back of Harry's brain screamed in desperate humiliation. 5 minutes later, Harry's water did seem noticeably cooler than room temperature, and Hermione had given him a few verbal pats on the head and told him to pronounce it more carefully next time, and gone off to help someone else. Professor Flitwick had given her a house point for helping him. Harry was gritting his teeth so hard his jaw ached, and that wasn't helping his pronunciation.
"I don't care if it's unfair competition. I know exactly what I'm doing with 2 extra hours every day. I'm going to sit in my trunk and study until I'm keeping up with Hermione Granger."
"Transfiguration is some of the most complex and dangerous magic you'll learn at Hogwarts,"
said Professor McGonagall. There was no trace of any levity upon the face of the stern old witch.
anyone messing around in my class will leave and not come back. You have been warned."
Her wand came down and tapped her desk, which smoothly reshaped itself into a pig. A couple of Muggle-born students gave out small yelps. The pig looked around and snorted, seeming confused, and then became a desk again. The Transfiguration Professor looked around the classroom, and then her eyes settled on one student.
"Mr. Potter," said Professor McGonagall, "you only received your school box a few days ago. Have you started reading your Transfiguration textbook?"
"No, sorry, Professor," Harry said.
"You needn't apologize, Mr. Potter. If you were required to read ahead, you would have been told to do so."
McGonagall's fingers rapped the desk in front of her.
"Mr. Potter, would you care to guess whether this is a desk which I transfigured into a pig, or if it began as a pig and I briefly removed the transfiguration? If you'd read the first chapter of your textbook, you would know."
Harry's eyebrows furrowed slightly.
I'd guess it'd be easier to start with a pig, since if it started as a desk, it might not know how to stand up."
Professor McGonagall shook her head.
"No fault to you, Mr. Potter, but the correct answer is that, in Transfiguration, you do not care to guess. Wrong answers will be marked with extreme severity. Questions left blank will be marked with great leniency. You must learn to know what you do not know. If I ask you a question, no matter how obvious or elementary, and you answer, 'I'm not sure,' I will not hold it against you, and anyone who laughs will lose his points. Can you tell me why this rule exists, Mr. Potter?"
"Because a single error in Transfiguration can be incredibly dangerous." "No."
"Correct. Transfiguration is more dangerous than apparition, which is not taught until your sixth year. Unfortunately, Transfiguration must be learned and practiced at a young age to maximize your adult ability. So, this is a dangerous subject, and you should be quite scared of making any mistakes, because none of my students have ever been permanently injured, and I would be extremely put out if you are the first class to spoil my record."
Several students gulped. Professor McGonagall stood up and moved over to the wall behind her desk, which held a polished wooden board.
"There are many reasons why Transfiguration is dangerous, but one reason stands above all the rest."
She produced a short quill with a thick end and used it to sketch letters in red, which she then underlined using the same marker in blue.
"Transfiguration is not permanent."
"Transfiguration is not permanent,"
said Professor McGonagall.
"Transfiguration is not permanent. Transfiguration is not permanent. Mr. Potter, suppose a student transfigured a block of wood into a cup of water, and you drank it. What do you imagine might happen to you when the transfiguration wore off?"
There was a pause.
"Excuse me, I should not have asked that of you, Mr. Potter. I forgot that you are blessed with an unusually pessimistic imagination."
"I'm fine," Harry said, swallowing hard. "So, the first answer is that I don't know,
The professor nodded approvingly. "But I imagine there might be wood in my stomach and in my bloodstream, and if any of that water had gotten absorbed into my body tissues, would it be wood pulp or solid wood or—"
Harry's grasp of magic failed him. He couldn't understand how wood mapped into water in the first place, so he couldn't understand what would happen after the water molecules were scrambled by ordinary thermal motions and the magic wore off and the mapping reversed. McGonagall's face was stiff.
"As Mr. Potter has correctly reasoned, he would become extremely sick and require immediate flewing to St. Mungo's Hospital if he was to have any chance of survival. Please, turn your textbooks to page 5.
Even without any sound in the moving picture, you could tell that the woman with horribly discolored skin was screaming.
"The criminal who originally transfigured gold into wine and gave it to this woman to drink, in payment of the debt, as she put it, received a sentence of 10 years in Azkaban. Please turn to page 6. That is a Dementor. They are the guardians of Azkaban. They suck away at your magic, your life, and any happy thoughts you try to have. The picture on page 7 is of the criminal 10 years later, on his release. You will note that he is dead. Yes, Mr. Potter?"
"Professor," Harry said, "if the worst happens in a case like that, is there any way of maintaining the transfiguration?"
"No,"
Professor McGonagall said flatly.
"Sustaining a transfiguration is a constant drain on your magic, which scales with the size of the target form, and you would need to recontact the target every few hours, which is, in a case like this, impossible. Disasters like this are unrecoverable."
Professor McGonagall leaned forwards, her face very hard.
"You will absolutely never, under any circumstances, transfigure anything into a liquid or gas. No water, no air, nothing like water, nothing like air, even if it is not meant to drink. Liquid evaporates. Little bits and pieces of it gets into the air. You will not transfigure anything that is to be burned. It will make smoke, and someone could breathe that smoke. You will never transfigure anything that could conceivably go inside anyone's body by any means. No food. Nothing that looks like food. Not even as a funny little prank where you mean to tell them about your mud pie before they actually eat it. You will never do it. Period. Inside this classroom, or out of it, or anywhere. Is that well understood by every single student?"
"Yes,"
said Harry, Hermione, and a few others. The rest seemed to be speechless.
"Is that well understood by every single student?"
"Yes."
"If you break any of these rules, you will not further study transfiguration during your stay at Hogwarts. Repeat along with me. I will never transfigure anything into a liquid or gas.
I will never transfigure anything into a liquid or gas,
said the students in ragged chorus.
Again? Louder. I will never transfigure anything into a liquid or gas.
I will never transfigure anything into a liquid or gas.
I will never transfigure anything that looks like food or anything else that goes inside a human body. I will never transfigure anything that is to be burned, because it could make smoke. You will never transfigure anything that looks like money, including muggle money,
said Professor McGonagall.
The goblins have ways to find out who did it. As a matter of recognized lore, the goblin nation is in a permanent state of war with all magical counterfeiters. They will not send auras. They will send an army.
I will never transfigure anything that looks like money,
repeated the students.
And above all,
said Professor McGonagall,
you will not transfigure any living subject, especially yourselves. It will make you very sick and possibly dead, depending on how you transfigure yourself and how long you maintain the change.
Professor McGonagall paused.
Mr. Potter is currently holding up his hand because he has seen an animagus transformation, specifically a human transforming into a cat and back again. But an animagus transformation is not free transfiguration.
Professor McGonagall took a small chunk of wood out of her pocket. With a tap of her wand, it became a glass ball. Then she said,
Gristferium!
And the glass ball became a steel ball. She tapped it with her wand one last time, and the steel ball became a piece of wood once more.
Gristferium transforms a subject of solid glass into a similarly shaped target of solid steel. It cannot do the reverse, nor can it transform a desk into a pig. The most general form of transfiguration, free transfiguration, which you will be learning here, is capable of transforming any subject into any target, at least so far as physical form is concerned. For this reason, free transfiguration must be done wordlessly. Using charms would require different words for every different transformation between subject and target.
Professor McGonagall gave her students a sharp look.
Some teachers begin with transfiguration charms and move on to free transfiguration afterwards. Yes, that would be much easier in the beginning, but it can set you in the poor mould, which impairs your abilities later. Here, you will learn free transfiguration from the very start, which requires that you cast the spell wordlessly, by holding the subject form, the target form, and the transformation within your own mind. And to answer Mr. Potter's question,
Professor McGonagall went on,
it is free transfiguration which you must never do to a living subject. There are charms and potions which can safely, reversibly transform living subjects in limited ways. An animagus with a missing limb will still be missing that limb after transforming, for example. Free transfiguration is not safe. Your body will change while it is transfigured. Breathing, for example, results in the constant loss of the body's stuff to the surrounding air. When the transfiguration wears off, and your body tries to revert to its original form, it will not quite be able to do so. If you press your wand to your body, and imagine yourself with golden hair, afterwards, your hair will fall out. If you visualize yourself as someone with clearer skin, you will be taking a long stay at St. Mungo's. And if you transfigure yourself into an adult bodily form, then, when the transfiguration wears off, you will die.
That explained why he had seen such things as fat boys or girls less than perfectly pretty. Or old people, for that matter. That wouldn't happen if you could just transfigure yourself every morning. Harry raised his hand and tried to signal Professor McGonagall with his eyes.
Yes, Mr. Potter.
Is it possible to transfigure a living subject into a target that's static, such as a coin? No, excuse me, I'm terribly sorry. Let's just say a steel ball.
Professor McGonagall shook her head.
Mr. Potter, even inanimate objects undergo small internal changes over time. There would be no visible changes to your body afterwards, and for the first minute you would notice nothing wrong. But in an hour you would be sick, and in a day you would be dead.
Excuse me. So, if I'd read the first chapter, I could have guessed that the desk was originally a desk and not a pig,
Harry said.
But only if I made the further assumption that you didn't want to kill the pig. That might seem highly probable, but
I can foresee that marking your tests will be an endless source of delight to me, Mr. Potter. But if you have other questions, can I please ask you to wait until after class?
No further questions, Professor.
No. Repeat after me,
said Professor McGonagall.
I will never try to transfigure any living subject, especially myself, unless specifically instructed to do so using a specialized charm or potion. If I'm not sure whether a transfiguration is safe, I will not try it until I have asked Professor McGonagall, or Professor Flitwick, or Professor Snape, or the Headmaster, who are the only recognized authorities on transfiguration at Hogwarts. Asking another student is not acceptable, even if they say they remember asking the same question. Even if the current defense professor at Hogwarts tells me that a transfiguration is safe, and even if I see the defense professor doing it and nothing bad seems to happen, I will not try it myself. I have the absolute right to refuse to perform any transfiguration about which I feel the slightest bit nervous. Since not even the headmaster of Hogwarts can order me to do otherwise, I certainly will not accept any such order from the defense professor, even if the defense professor threatens to deduct 100 house points and have me expelled. If I break any of these rules, I will not further study transfiguration during my time at Hogwarts. We will repeat these rules at the start of every class for the first month,
said Professor McGonagall.
And now, we will begin with matches as subjects and needles as targets. Put away your wands, thank you. By begin, I meant that you will begin taking notes.
Half an hour before the end of class, Professor McGonagall handed out the matches. At the end of the class, Hermione had a silvery-looking match, and the entire rest of the class, muggle-born or otherwise, had exactly what they'd started with. Professor McGonagall awarded her another point for Ravenclaw. After the Transfiguration class was dismissed, Hermione came over to Harry's desk as Harry was putting away his books into his pouch.
"You know,"
Hermione said with an innocent expression on her face,
"I earned 2 points for Ravenclaw today."
"So you did," Harry said shortly.
"But that wasn't as good as your 7 points,"
she said.
"I guess I'm just not as intelligent as you."
Harry finished feeding his homework into the pouch and turned to Hermione with his eyes narrowed. He had actually forgotten about that. She batted her eyelashes at him.
"We have lessons every day, though. I wonder how long it would take you to find some more Hufflepuffs to rescue. Today is Monday, so that gives you until Thursday."
The two of them stared into each other's eyes, unblinking. Harry spoke first.
"Of course, you realize this means war."
"I didn't know we'd been at peace."
All of the other students were now watching with fascinated eyes. All of the other students, plus, unfortunately, Professor McGonagall.
"Eh, Mr. Potter,"
sang Professor McGonagall from the other side of the room.
"I have some good news for ye. Madame Pomfrey has approved your suggestion for preventing breakage in her spinster wickets, and the plan is to finish the job by the end of next week. I'd say that deserves, let's call it 10 points for Ravenclaw."
Hermione's face was gaping in betrayal and shock. Harry imagined his own face didn't look much different.
"Professor," Harry hissed.
"Those 10 points are unquestionably deserved, Mr. Potter. I would not hand out house points on a whim. To you, it might have been a simple matter of seeing something fragile and suggesting a way to protect it, but spinster wickets are expensive, and the headmaster was not pleased the last time one broke."
Professor McGonagall looked thoughtful.
I wonder if any other student has ever earned 17 house points on his first day of lessons. I'll have to look it up, but I suspect that's a new record. Perhaps we should have an announcement at dinner time."
"Professor!"
Harry shrieked.
"This is our war! Stop meddling!"
"Now you have until Thursday of next week, Mr. Potter. Unless, of course, you engage in some sort of mischief and lose house points before then. Addressing a professor disrespectfully, for example."
Professor McGonagall put a finger on her cheek and looked reflective.
"I expect you'll hit negative numbers before the end of Friday."
Harry's mouth snapped shut. He sent his best death glare at McGonagall, but she only seemed to find it amusing.
"Yes, definitely announcement at dinner,"
Professor McGonagall mused.
"But it wouldn't do to offend the Slytherins, so the announcement should be brief. Just the number of points and the fact of the record. And if anyone comes to you for help with their schoolwork and is disappointed that you haven't even started reading your textbooks, you can always refer them to Miss Granger."
"Professor!"
said Hermione in a rather high-pitched voice. Professor McGonagall ignored her.
"May, I wonder how long it will take before Miss Granger does something deserving of a dinner-time announcement. I look forward to seeing it, whatever it may be."
Harry and Hermione, by unspoken mutual consent, turned and stormed out of the classroom. They were followed by a trail of hypnotized Ravenclaws.
Harry said, "are we still on for after dinner?"
"Of course,"
said Hermione.
I wouldn't want you to fall further behind on your studying.
Why, thank you. And let me say that as brilliant as you are already, I can't help but wonder what you'll be like once you have some elementary training in rationality.
Is it really that useful? It didn't seem to help you with charms or transfiguration.
There was a slight pause.
Well, I only got my school books 4 days ago. That's why I had to earn those 17 house points without using my wand.
4 days ago? Maybe you can't read 8 books in 4 days, but you might have at least read one. How many days would it take you to finish at that rate? You know all the mathematics, so can you tell me what's 8 times 4 divided by 0?
I've got classes now, which you didn't, but weekends are free, so limit of 8 times 4 divided by epsilon as epsilon approaches 0 plus 10:47 a.m. on Sunday.
I did it in 3 days, actually.
2:47 p.m. on Saturday it is, then. I'm sure I'll find the time somewhere.
And there was evening, and there was morning. The first day. Chapter 16. Lateral Thinking.
I'm not a psychopath. I'm just very creative.
As soon as he walked into the defense classroom on Wednesday, Harry knew that this subject was going to be different. It was, for a start, the largest classroom he had yet seen at Hogwarts, akin to a major university classroom, with layered tiers of desks facing a